Welcome to Always Searching, the podcast challenging conventional wisdom about health and wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. I'm delighted that you're here. Welcome to Always Searching. My guest is a space scientist serving as the executive director for TRISH, which is an acronym for Translational Research Institute for Space Health, which is located at the Baylor College of Medicine. Welcome to Always Searching, my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Dorit Dranaville.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Dorit, it's such a pleasure. You and I have been working together well over, probably it's been a decade, when we first began the Decadal Review for NASA, looking at the impact of sex and gender. And I know you and I have traveled, we've gone to conferences together, but we've never really had time just to sit and chat. So thank you and welcome to the podcast. I'd like to know a little bit about your background. Where were you born?
I was born in Israel. I was born in Tel Aviv, and I immigrated to the United States with my family when I was pretty young. I was 10 years old, and I have real distinct memories of being this odd immigrant child. My English was very poor. We first moved to Orlando, Florida, and I came into the classroom at, I think it was sixth grade at the end of the year, and I was sort of the odd kid trying to fit in and just like feeling so like a fish out of water. And it was really traumatic for my entire family as immigrants. So yeah, that was my humble beginning.
Why did your family move from Israel to the United States?
You know, it's a really great question. And I only figured it out maybe about a month ago. So it seems kind of odd. I'm 57, I'm going to be 58 soon. And it took me, you know, nearly 50 years to figure this out. So I heard a podcast like this one about a book that somebody had written about what happened to Israelis after the Yom Kippur War in 1973, where Israel really got beat pretty badly. There was such a huge effect on the nation, the morale of the nation. Mm-hmm. And I remember my father at the time, he in 1973, so he was born in 1931. So you could do the math. The Israeli men have to serve even after they do their service when they're 18 years old for 3 years. They have to come back every year actually to give service even when they're older. And I think he was tired of it. He was tired of always living under threat, and he was tired of being in a war situation, as old as he was with his family. And I'm pretty sure that was what was sort of the turning point, because it was 1973. And then I think he started the immigration process very soon after, when we moved to the U.S. in 1976.
That must have been such an extraordinary challenge to go from an environment such as Israel to the United States. And you were really at a pivotal point in your life. Did you know you wanted to get into science? Did you know you wanted to go into space?
No, not at all. In fact, it really came down to a very brilliant teacher. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was a bright child. I picked up English fairly quickly and did really well in school. And I had a biology teacher in high school that really kind of changed my direction, because I was pretty excited about especially physiology and anatomy. I just found the body so fascinating. And that love affair with the body and biology is sort mm-hmm. of remained all through the years.
I had something similar. I had this fantastic physiology teacher when I was in eighth grade. It's funny how something so young can change, you know, the direction of your life. I'm thinking about today. It's the 53rd anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon
yeah.
landing.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to believe so many years, but we were all children. At least I'm a child of the Apollo years. And I always know that when I think about the moon, I always think about being that little girl wanting to be a doctor practicing on the moon. That was sort of my goal. Fortunately, my family never told me that, you know, women couldn't be part of the space program at that time. So I had this delusion that I could do it, but it did inspire me to want to, you know, go into the space program. What was that pivot point? You love science, but what was that pivot point to move you, migrate you towards the space program?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny. I've always loved sci-fi. I grew up with Star Trek. That's my favorite show. I loved everything about, you know, the concept of humanity in the future. But honestly, I kind of fell into the space program. And in my heart of heart, for me, the exciting part about working with the space program is about what space does to the body and how the body adapts to it. So I'm not your traditional space freak. I am more of a biologist, physiologist, scientist, love of medicine and the body and the adaptation of living things to the environment. And for me, space just is such an amazing place for us to adapt to live in that it's almost secondary. And to be honest, I mean, I think space is super cool, especially seeing all the latest images from the web, just phenomenal possibilities, but it is about the living things and how they survive and become resilient. That is always the thing that gets me most excited.
So you mentioned the word resilience, and you and I often talk about that, especially as women in science. You do need to have a level of resilience to persevere. What during your career trajectory, because I think you also went into industry, did you know that you needed to follow something else? You needed to follow your heart. You needed to follow that Star Trek journey to get you into space.
You mentioned the word industry, and what came up for me immediately is, I'll never forget this. I worked in biotech for about 8 years. I dared to challenge the CEO of the company I worked for in an open forum with other people listening. I challenged something that he stated. And I mean, it's just my nature. I'm a scientist. I question everything. And it's just what it's in my blood. I question everyone and everything. And that was like the first moment where I learned later that, you know, my boss basically had to do some heavy talking to keep him from firing me. And, and it just like, it hit me like, you have to learn things outside of just the truth, right? So to be successful in the world, saying the truth is not enough. It's how you say it, when you say it, to who you say it. And, you know, it sort of went against everything that I believed in as a scientist. But at the end of the day, as a scientist, you not only want to pursue truth, but you also want to bring about change and be effective. And sometimes to bring about change and to be effective, it's more than just speaking the truth. It's bringing people along. And so the softer skills have been absolutely critical in learning to kind of filter myself, which didn't come easy, still doesn't come easy. And so especially in this job, boy, oh boy, did I have to learn quickly.
Well, first of all, you're a Sabra. So for folks who don't know what a Sabra is, it's not just that cactus. You know, you're a pioneer from Israel, and Israelis are renowned for speaking their mind. I just watched the Netflix documentary on Shimon Peres. So if we could have one-tenth of what he had, the world would be a truly remarkable place. Mm-hmm. So you have that quality. You were also coming from another country to the United States. So I think you had to develop that skill set to speak up. When you spoke up for what you believed, were you afraid you were going to be fired? Did you think about the consequences?
Not at the time. Of course not.
What made you want to do it? loaded question, isn't it?
Why do we do everything that we do? Honestly, I don't any longer. I used to shoot from the hip. Mm-hmm. And it served me well in this job because in innovation work, you can't take forever to make a decision, and indecision is worse than a bad decision.
Yes.
And so an indecision grinds the organization to a halt. And there are people who I've watched who wring their hands and go and are so worried about making the wrong decision right. that they can't move ahead. So for me, in doing innovation work with this organization, it served me well to sometimes shoot from the hip. But, and I even had this conversation today with a close colleague, when you do that, you need to make sure that there are people around you that watch out so that you mm-hmm. don't shoot from the hip and hit the mm-hmm. wrong target, you know, and shoot yourself in the foot, for mm-hmm. example. So it is, I have learned to recognize that that's my natural inclination, and I have to surround myself with people and empower them to tell me that hey, okay, it's good that we want to move ahead quickly on this. That's the right instinct, but let's consider this for just a little bit longer.
So, you know, we work in a world that is traditionally more male-oriented. You think about the right stuff. Back in those days when the only astronauts were male astronauts and the environment was really male-centric, even though women were truly the pioneers to get people from this place on Earth to the moon. Have you noticed from working in industry to working in the space community that it's a different type of environment and that you have to have a different type of support system around you to be able to do what you need to do? You know, you talk about innovation.
I'll be really straightforward here. I myself have ignored it. I'm sure it's there. Mm-hmm. I know it's there, and I've seen it. But for me personally, it has never held me back. I think it's because I am so outspoken and so don't care what people think, and so I just... I have looked around in rooms and said, "Hey, I'm only one woman or one mm-hmm. of two women," and I've called organizations on that before. As you know, Sarah, we've discussed it. Yeah. And so I've spoken up before, but I've never felt like my sex has held me back. But there were no women to mentor me. So having said that, I've been able to have male mentors, which got kind of awkward at times, to mm-hmm. be honest with you, because when I was a younger woman and mm-hmm. more good looking than I am today, there was some awkwardness with some of my male mentors. I can't say there wasn't. And sometimes I felt like maybe there was a line that may have been crossed a little bit. So then you have to always ask yourself, okay, was the line crossed? How do I deal with that? And so if I was a man, I probably wouldn't have to deal with it, or maybe I would, but there were no women mentors. And so I would say that it would have been helpful to have women mentors, particularly because I juggled having children. I juggled, you know, having two kids in graduate school and a postdoc and raising kids while I was working full time and commuting and had to juggle all of that. It would have been very helpful to have a woman mentor.
So, you know, you're talking about juggling all the different aspects to your life. And so you had a 27-hour day job, basically. How did you balance it? You know, we talk about on this podcast how to realistically transform our lives into a way that we achieve balance and wellness. How have you been able to do that?
You can't. You really
fair
can't.
Answer. Fair answer.
No, I mean, I think what you have to, there, I think for me, there's no way you could be perfect at everything at all times. So yeah. There were moments when I was a pretty crappy mom and had to focus on work because that's what needed to get done. And then there were moments when my kids really, really needed me and I probably didn't do my fair share at work. But I think over, you know, the entire career, I think everything does balance out in the end. But I think you kind of go through different phases. And I look back, I mean, I laugh about this now. I put my daughter in daycare when she was 2 weeks old.
Really?
As a postdoc.
I didn't even know you could do that.
As a postdoc, I did not have maternity leave. If I left the lab, everything stopped. And so putting my child in daycare before, you know, she was old enough, but she's fine. It's like, it was fine. You know, I was able to go and breastfeed her during the day and, you know, I was accommodated. And we are lucky in science that our work is actually very flexible. So there may be times when you're in the lab in the evenings or the weekends or holidays, but you could probably leave at noon or, you know, even at 4 o'clock and go breastfeed your baby.
Well, one of the things we've been trying to do with my nonprofit, which is iGiant, again, the world of acronyms, the impact of gender and sex and innovation, novel technologies, you know, an accelerator for gendered innovation, is to begin developing those policies for everyone, not just women, but for everyone, because we all have family responsibilities, whether it's for children or parents or pets or whomever is in your life. So you saw it from that one end, and hopefully, you know, as we go into this century, we're going to do so much better. What I've loved about you is you are outspoken, and people who know you know what you stand for. And I think that's an important lesson, Dorit, because there is no hiding back from what you believe. So when you do speak, people trust what you're saying. You moved into the space world. I want to talk about, you were with the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, and again, those acronyms, NSBRI, evolved into Trish, became the executive director. Can you tell us a little bit about your leadership style within Trish? And then I also want to talk about how the body adapts and why you were attracted to being part of Trish.
Thanks for that question. So I just completed a 360 review, and it was the most difficult thing for people who don't know you. You put out a survey to people that you work with inside the organization, outside, some of your stakeholders, and then they give you feedback in an anonymous way, and then you kind of receive a report. And it was important for me to do that because I've been director now of this institute for 5.5 years, and I know I know I've changed. I know I've grown in this role. And the thing that I find really interesting is that what you think you are putting out there and your intentions are completely different from how you are perceived. Mm-hmm. And the first step is to recognize that that is a reality, that your reality may not be somebody else's reality of you. Mm-hmm. And so that was like the first huge lesson learned. And I'm really trying to be thoughtful about how I evolve myself and evolve with the Institute, because the Institute is a very different Institute. So the Institute needed something very different in the very beginning as we were in the growth phase. We're in a phase right now. We just had a successful renewal from NASA. We have another 5.5 years in our cooperative agreement. We are fully, thank you. It was a lot of hard work by the entire team. We are fully staffed in the sense that all the key positions are filled with individuals that I absolutely feel so good about. And that's not been the case throughout the evolution of the Institute. We've had to shift individuals that were not a good fit. But right now, it feels like everybody's in place. The Institute is doing really, really well. And so my role is to get the hell out of the way and let these folks do what they need to do, so that I can focus on the really big vision strategic stuff that will enable us to take the investment by the government and make it that much bigger. So it has been a real growth opportunity for me to, because I just want to get in there. I love this stuff, but I got to get out of the way and let my chief scientist do her thing and my deputy director do his thing and my communications gal to do her thing and my finance gal to do her thing and get out of their way. And so that has been a huge effort on my part.
Well, I think it's great that you're learning as you're going through this experience. So why don't you share a little bit about Trish? I love the point that you've got translational. So here we're on Earth and we develop technologies that help us explore. And then when you're in space, you're developing technologies that hopefully have benefit back on Earth. Can you share just a few highlights and how you've pioneered some of this amazing work that's happening right now through Trish?
Yeah, thanks. So again, let's come back to the basics. I'm a fanatic about understanding the human body mm-hmm. and how we adapt both to a stressful environment, which could make us more resilient and actually make us, mm-hmm. you know, turn on things that can make us better, and can also be damaging if the stress is too high and we're not properly adapted to it. So both of those things can happen. So when we think about our mission, which is to enable humans to travel in deep space for long periods of time, we are taking a body that's adapted for gravity, that's adapted for all the things we take for granted here on Earth, including being protected from space ionizing radiation, and we're putting it into a very stressful environment. And so there are things that occur that are what you call adaptive. Those are good mm-hmm. things. For example, when the fluid shifts occurs, and you basically have all the fluids that would normally distribute throughout the body, and gravity's pulling down on the fluids in the lower half of your body, they get redistributed more equally. And now you have fluids volumes in the upper extremities and the head that you wouldn't normally have on Earth. The body adapts. And the way it does that is it reduces the plasma volume, as you know, Sarah, better than most people, about 10 to 15%. Mm-hmm. It removes that extra volume because that is what it's supposed to do to stay healthy. And then mm-hmm. the red blood cells follow because now you've got a concentration of red blood cells. So we've seen that the red blood cells go away in a new way, a new process, and maybe that may lead to anemia. Does it lead to anemia over a long period of time? We don't know whether that change is going to be maladaptive, bad. If you stayed in space forever and ever, it probably wouldn't. The problem mm-hmm. is we're switching back and forth. Right. So the Institute really is focused about not only understanding what happens to the body, we are partnered with NASA to make sure that we prevent bad things from happening to humans who will live and work in space, in deep space, for long periods of time. And we are developing all kinds of approaches, including medical technologies and new food technologies, to keep those humans healthy. So we're creating a brand new healthcare system in a very different environment. We don't have to worry about, you know, CPT codes. We don't have to worry about reimbursements. We don't have to worry about you know, interfacing with all kinds of, you know, insurance companies and mm-hmm. all those things. We just have to create the perfect healthcare system in a small form.
So it's really moving us towards human factor precision medicine, you know, looking at what yep. defines us, because that one size fits all approach certainly doesn't work here yep. on Earth, and it's not going to work in space where those very small differences have significant impact.
Absolutely.
Can you give an example? I'm going to remind you, it's been a while. You helped a friend of mine. She was dying of ovarian cancer, and her husband, I think, reached out to you because they needed something to help protect her gut from all the radiation she was getting
for treatment.
Yeah. Yes. Where are we in that? And how does that benefit us on Earth? So you talk about space radiation being bad in space, but we're being exposed to radiation here, hopefully to help us, but we know there can be side effects. So what are some of the technologies that Trish and NSBRI had pioneered that actually have benefit for us on Earth?
Yeah, so this is my favorite project. In fact, the CEO of the company just called me yesterday. I'm supposed to call him
Perfect
back.
Timing.
So I still keep up with them. They keep me Great. Updated on where they're at. So I met this company. We were looking for investing in small companies that had interesting products. And what they had developed, this is a spin out of a University of Florida laboratory where Gatorade was also mm-hmm. invented. In that same place. Mm-hmm. And what this is it's a medical food, it's a drink, and it's comprised of seven very specific amino acids that have the ability to keep the gut lumen, the epithelial cells, these are the cells that line the gut, mm-hmm. really, really happy. It keeps them happy to the point where they are not they're less susceptible to damage either by radiation or even excessive bacteria toxins or, you know, any kind of problem that you would have in the gut. And so by keeping those cells extremely happy, you are preventing an immune response, an inflammation. And that inflammation, keeping inflammation down in the gut, affects the entire body. It has an effect on every organ system. So what this company had was just this drink. And I remember, I still have pictures from this. The first meeting we had with them, we had our entire advisory board, and there were venture capitalists there. There were physicians, there were scientists and entrepreneurs on my board. And they came in with a glass bottle with lab tape on it. And they showed us this thing. I said, well, I want my entire board to taste it. And this was before the days where they, you know, added the taste all, you know, it's the tasting is a whole other field, yeah, you know, making sure it's palatable. Sure. So we got out the crystal, and I made all my board members drink this thing before they voted on giving these guys their first funding. And it was a small amount of money. It was like $100,000 or something like that. But it gave this company validation and credibility. And they have since, because of our original investment, they are now commercial. Huge deal with Nestle and a whole bunch of other companies. They are on the market, have been selling this as a medical food. And believe I have 12 of those in my fridge. And hey, Sarah, I got COVID. And when I started to have a little bit of GI upset, I was down on those drinks, let me tell you.
What about the smell and taste? Did you have that from COVID, and did this help you at all?
You know, I didn't have a problem with the smell and taste because I was quadruple protected. I had the two boosters and the two shots, but the GI effects really went away with the drink. So that was pretty happy.
That is so, what's the name of this product again?
Enterade. You can buy it on Amazon.
So you have really, again, it helps our astronauts, but it certainly has huge benefit for here on Earth. Can you give another example? If a company wants to connect with Trish, how does that work? Do they have to respond to a request for information? Can they just contact you directly? How do you do your due diligence to get them on board?
That's a great question. So because we're an innovation institute, unlike the government, we have to be extremely agile and always open to new ideas. Yes. So when an opportunity comes in the door, we have to be able to move. So we put in place something like, I was counting it the other day, 7 or 8 different procurement mechanisms, some of which are routine. We put out calls for proposals for areas that NASA has really prioritized for us, or we meet with our advisory board and they, you know, and we have a new chief scientist now, so she's got some thoughts about where we need to go. And let me say this, she used to be in NASA and has now joined our team. So she's like rolling up her sleeves and is able to move a lot more quickly, you know, without having to go through the typical slow, but methodical and very good, you know, NASA processes. Anyway, so we always want to hear new ideas. You never know where you're going to get a great new idea. Like recently I went to the Institute for Food Technologies conference, 18,000 people from all over the world came to Chicago, and they're all figuring out different kinds of foods. So we know that for a mission to Mars, the current food system isn't going to work. And so met with a company from Israel called Aleph Farms. They are 3D printing steaks. So this is, it doesn't sound great, but they're 3D. It doesn't, I know, but there are people who will absolutely want to have that meat after, and we just can't. Right. So you're able to kind of open up the net, cast the net really wide. So if somebody wanted to bring forward a really great idea, we always want to hear ideas. And so there is an email we'll have to put it with the podcast. I can't remember what the email is. Or you just go to the Trish website.
Trish
website at Baylor College of Medicine. So you can just Google it and find us, but send me an email. We vet everything. Every idea that comes in, we vet. And so you asked how we do that. I generally send it to We have our chief scientist, chief scientific officer, Jennifer Fogarty. We have our chief medical officer, Emmanuel Urqueta. We have our senior biomedical engineer, and we got a few other folks that sort of help us vet things. But we discuss things every Monday afternoon. We talk about really cool ideas and we decide whether it's something worth pursuing.
You know, when we think about long-duration space missions, every system in the body changes, as you say, adapts to the microgravity environment. What would you say is sort of a showstopper? And if we don't figure it out, we're not going to Mars, and we're certainly not going to stay on the moon for a long period of time.
Okay, you're not gonna like it, because it isn't about the body. It's food. It's still food.
It's food.
Yeah. I mean, you can worry about all kinds of medical things that could or could not happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's risks for all kinds of stuff. But at the end of the day, if the food that we're sending with the crew, so the concern is there are some vitamins that are labile. They will not remain stable. And we know if you have a vitamin B deficiency, there's effects. If you have, protein, if the protein that I send along isn't palatable after 3 years of sitting on the surface of Mars because I had to pre-populate the surface of Mars, if you don't get enough protein, that's going to be a problem. So there are things that are so basic, just food. We've got to figure out the food. And right now, even on the space station, according to Michelle Perchonik, who I just met with last week, so she had the latest stats for me, but she was head of the food program at for the ISS and shuttle. And she told me, okay, variety is still a problem. Variety, even on the ISS, I think they claim 500 or something like that, different products, 500 to 600 different products, but that includes every permutation of coffee. So coffee would be one, coffee with milk would be another, coffee with milk and sugar would be another. So that's three right there. So if you add all of that, I think she said something on the order of maybe 200 different food products as a variety. That doesn't sound like it would be bad, but think about it. 300 days,
that's
300,
a long time.
Sorry, 3 years, not 300 days, 300 days in a year. Mm-hmm. If you're going to go on that Mars mission, it's going to be, 1.5 to 2 or 3 years. If you're going to do the flyby versus the stay on the surface. And that is not enough variety. And that food is not going to be stable for that long.
It's the nutritional value. It's the same here on Earth. Because we have a variety of food doesn't mean we're actually healthy. We have, certainly generations of people who are obese, and we have malnourished individuals, and we have food deserts. So do you think if we could figure this out for space exploration, we could actually improve our communities here?
Absolutely. That's the vision. So for me, the vision is to make this much, much bigger. So right now I have a very limited budget, as you know, with federal funding getting more and more tight, very limited budget, but the problems are huge and the applications are huge. And so because space is a forcing function for us to innovate, it forces us to think differently. That I really believe that that's where we're going to make all the breakthroughs.
And you are doing it in a way already, because you're partnering with the commercial space sector. For example, I know you're the repository for a lot of the data that's come out of that recent SpaceX flight. How about the commercial space sector stepping up and working on these issues? How do they get that fantastic food on the mission where Cyan was at? And I think she mentioned she was eating pizza and M&Ms and all the, comfort food. How do we do it? Is that just because it was a short-term mission?
It was a three-day mission. I mean, you could do anything. And in fact, one of our astronauts, Jeff Hoffman, says during we put out a documentary, as you know, he talks about, we have a whole food section in a documentary. People should watch it. It's really great. Space health, surviving in the final frontier. And so what he says is, you could put up with anything. He was a shuttle astronaut. You could put up with anything for 2 weeks. Now, when you're talking about years, that becomes a whole different story. Mm-hmm. So let me go back to the commercial spaceflight. So what we're seeing with commercial spaceflight, and thank God we have the partnership between NASA and the commercial sector now that have enabled us to maintain you know, our ability to take astronauts into space using from U.S. Yeah. soil. So that, hooray. And more companies are coming online, especially now with the whole situation with the mm-hmm. Russians. Mm-hmm. And so what they've enabled us to do now is they've opened up a whole other possibility. We are now able to take technologies into space and test them that do not require government resources, which enables us to take the investment that, the government has made in our institute and now apply it in another way and really help advance and sort of mature the technologies in this other sector. The other thing that this other sector is doing is it's got big plans. I mean, there will mm-hmm. be commercial destinations in space. There, the price will come down. There will be stuff up there. It won't just be billionaires going to space. As you know, scientists are going up. Mm-hmm. There will be people who work in space, who will be working in space. And so the concern for me is that we really heavily screen astronauts for all the medical pre-existing conditions. Yes. But when you start to send regular people into space, right. We may have some issues, so we have to really be thoughtful about this. And so we're really excited to be working with all the commercial spaceflight companies, not just SpaceX. We're working with Axiom. We collected data on them. We're working with Space Adventures. We're working with Blue Origin. We're working with Sierra Space, and we're having conversations with Virgin and Boeing. And all of these, as they come online, will be ready to make sure that the research they do with their subjects, their private individuals, will actually be credible, really good science that makes sense.
And that is going to make a huge difference. I don't think I've ever asked you this question, but do you want to go into space? And if you do, what are you going to take with you?
So somebody did ask me the question. So I have to qualify it. I would absolutely go to space. I would even go to the moon. It would have to be a short trip because you and I know how much radiation is up there. Mm-hmm. But I would do that. I would risk going to the moon with the space radiation environment. I know there's no way I would go to Mars because I'm all about the food. I'm all about the food, and the thought of not having a variety of food just depresses me.
Well, Dorit, I wish we could be in the same place and have that glass of wine and eat that perfect piece of chocolate together. And soon enough, and I believe with the work you're doing through Trish, we'll probably be able to bring it with us when we go to the moon, where I can practice medicine and you can change the world from a different vantage point. I want to thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank you for your collegiality, your curiosity, your creativity, your wonderful sense of humor, which has always kept us grounded on this beautiful planet. And I just appreciate your time. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. And you've been an incredible advocate for all those issues that not enough people are standing up and talking about. And you've been my beacon, my absolute light in that arena. Thank you for that.
Well, absolutely. I think we're each other's champions. And with that, until next time, we're always searching. Thank you so much for listening to Always Searching. Please share it with your community. This podcast was produced by Noah Jones and hosted by me, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. Until next time, we're always searching.